Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shutdown of the US government, which begins at midnight Tuesday, and speak with Jonathan Shait, a writer for New York Magazine, where he has an article, The House GOP's Legislative Strike. We will discuss the strategy behind the Republican shutdown of government that goes back to a House Republican retreat in Williamsburg, where they met after their demoralizing 2012 election defeat and decided to go on strike and force Obama to accede to their demands without offering him any concessions. Then we will speak with Noam Schieber, a senior editor at the New Republic, about his contention that this shutdown of government will be much worse for the Republicans than the 1996 shutdown that benefited Bill Clinton was for Newt Gingrich. We will discuss his article at the New Republic, Countdown to Shutdown, and the last-minute efforts by Republicans engaged in government by extortion to portray themselves as being reasonable while accusing the Democrats of being obstructionists. Then finally, we will speak with Tom Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University and author of The Age of Austerity, who has an article at the New York Times, How Did Conservatives Get This Radical? We will discuss what is driving the tribalism and xenophobia of the Tea Party radicals as they careen forth in an all-or-nothing push to either get their way or shut down the government and ruin the economy. And joining us now is Jonathan Shait, who's a writer for the New York Magazine. He was previously a senior editor at the New Republic and a former assistant editor of the American Prospect. His latest article at New York Magazine is The House GOP's Legislative Strike. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Shait.
Thank you.
And what's your sense as the clock ticked down now in the last couple of hours before the government shuts down? You wrote your article in the New York Magazine, The House GOP's Legislative Strike, suggests that there's a method to their madness. But at the last minute, do you expect a last-minute deal?
I think there's a pretty good chance that there will be a last-minute deal. The House Republican leadership has been trying to avoid a government shutdown for quite a long time. They've been forced into it by the most conservative members, but I don't think it's a high proportion of the conference. Byron York reported, the Washington Examiner, he's a conservative reporter who's very plugged in with Republicans, that as many as 175 Republicans do not want to shut down the government. And if that's true, I can't imagine they'll actually go through with it.
Well, there are at least 25 Republicans led by Peter King who basically wanted a clean CR. But at the last minute, the House is going to lay in some conditions, new conditions, delaying for a year the individual mandate in the health care law and ending federal health care subsidies for Hill staffers and lawmakers. Now, the Senate's already said they're going to strip it out. So it goes back and forth like a ping pong ball here, and we're running out of time.
We're running out of time, but, you know, they can move very, very quickly. If they want to hold a vote and rush something, they can do it fast. And it's not as if at midnight planes start falling out of the sky. If you go over a few minutes, an hour, it doesn't make a very large difference. As long as by the morning they've passed something, I don't think it makes a big difference at all. I'm not saying for certain that'll happen, but, you know, I think John Boehner has been forced to placate the most conservatives by pushing their shutdown cause as far as he possibly can. And if that's true, and I think it is, then he can't signal his willingness to continue the government until the very last minute, because then he won't have at least pretended to be pushing the limit on Obamacare. Now, the debt ceiling is a different story. The House Republican leadership has been threatening to use that as a hostage for a long time, telling the members they have real leverage to do that. That's not only a much more likely situation to have a standoff, but it's also vastly more dangerous one where the consequences of failing to lift the debt ceiling are many, many times as dangerous as those of the government shutdown.
So would that mean then, Jonathan Shait, that the angry Tea Party caucus that were forced at the last minute to drink the poison, they're given permission to come back with a vengeance in mid-October?
I think that's right, and that's exactly the signals that the Republican leadership has been sending out. The article that I wrote that you referenced essentially laid this all out back in January, where the Republican leadership sat down and decided in conjunction with the most conservative members that their plan was to use the debt ceiling to try to force President Obama to accept fiscal changes that he otherwise would not accept. Now, at first, they were talking about the Paul Ryan budget and cuts to retirement programs. Then they started talking about tax cuts, but they really have settled on the Affordable Care Act as the poison pill they want to try to force the president to accept. But I think they'll just take something. The general strategy that they've settled upon is to try to use the debt ceiling to force President Obama to give them concessions and to refuse under any circumstances to offer any concessions of their own.
So this meeting that took place in Williamsburg, Virginia, back in January, after their stinging defeat, the Republicans met and they came up with what's called the Williamsburg Accord. And it seems, as you point out, that the liberals and the liberal press didn't notice it. The conservative press did. But it does explain that there's a strategy behind what the Republicans have been doing, which many people sort of think doesn't make any sense. And what you're suggesting here is that, in fact, they have a strategy here to force Obama to accede to large chunks of the Republican agenda without having to offer any policy concessions of their own.
That's right. And the strategy is what I call the legislative strike. They have boycotted any negotiations with President Obama, and then they boycotted any negotiations with the Senate Democrats and decided any legislative changes they get would be obtained by threatening a shutdown, but much more threatening the debt ceiling to force Democrats to give them their way, as opposed to the traditional give and take where one party offers something and the other party offers something back in return.
So this has been going on then. I mean, the last thing that they sent, that they were going to send back to the Senate was an entire, and this is tied to the debt ceiling, was every bill that they've sent to the Senate that wasn't passed, they're going to send it back. I mean, isn't this an extraordinary change, though, that they're basically won't take a yes for an answer? They just will simply do this until they get all of their way. The word compromise is not in the lexicon anymore.
I think that's right. Well, look, we've had stalemate before between the president and the opposing party. But stalemate usually means that neither side gets its way, neither side gets any real changes in the law. The Republicans are actually trying something very different than stalemate. They're assuming that the failure to agree means they get their way. That means they get to use the threat of a default on the debt ceiling or possibly a government shutdown, but more likely, like I said, the debt ceiling to try to force the president to give him policies that would otherwise be unacceptable. And that really is completely novel. And I also think it's a dangerous development in American government that President Obama is at least putatively committed to stopping, because that would really change the nature of the relationship between the president and Congress.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Chait, a writer for New York Magazine. He was previously a senior editor at The New Republic and a former assistant editor of The American Prospect. His latest article at New York Magazine is The House GOP's Legislative Strike. So if this is the new normal, government by extortion, at what point do the Peter Kings, and he's a conservative, and the others decide to assert themselves? Because I see an analogy with hostage taking, the United States government does not negotiate with terrorists. So why, in psychological terms, it doesn't seem to be a very good strategy to keep giving in to extremists, and because they keep pushing the envelope. At what point do we have some adult supervision here?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that the number one thing that has to happen in the short term is that President Obama has to not only refuse to negotiate on the debt ceiling, he has to stick to that position and just not waver for no matter what. Because if he pays a ransom on the debt ceiling now, he'll have enshrined this permanently in the fabric of relations between Congress and the president. And I mean, every time the debt ceiling has to be lifted, Congress, or at least if it's a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, will expect to be paid some sort of policy concession in return for just not blowing up the world economy. And number one, you'll just keep passing over the table more and more ransom payments continuously. Number two, eventually the two parties won't be able to agree on the exact size of the ransom payment, and the world economy will blow up anyway in the confusion. So President Obama's options are not to pay a ransom and take a risk of the economy blowing up immediately, or to pay a ransom and to have the near certainty that it will eventually blow up. So I think his only play is to not pay the debt ceiling ransom, is to say we're going to revert to the way things have always done, where the debt ceiling sometimes is used for posturing, where the Congress uses it to give speeches about how irresponsible and bad the president is, but passes the debt ceiling. It doesn't try to trade it for something, as opposed to what the Republicans are trying to do with it now, which is really use it to extract unacceptable conditions from the president.
Well, what's odd about this one, though, is that we're not talking about current legislation where they're extorting in order to get their way. They actually want to retroactively go back and undo a law that was passed by both houses, signed by the president, and upheld by the Supreme Court. There's no right. limit to that, is there, if you keep, you know, retroactively wanting to change reality?
Well, there's nothing wrong with undoing laws you disapprove of, but you need to go through the normal channels. That means you need to elect a majority of the Senate, and you need to win the presidency and pass the law that way. You can't do it by holding one of the chambers and threatening to blow up the world economy if you can't undo the law. That's completely outside the bounds of what historically has been considered normal political and legitimate political behavior.
So are they getting away with this because of our binary press, where it's in the universe of discourse there's only two black and white positions, equal and opposite, and therefore, it's a he said and she said situation? Is it because you keep hearing about, you know, the failure of bipartisanship and calls for bipartisanship, and it seems like if you're a centrist at the moment, you're living in a fool's paradise.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I think there's certainly legitimacy to the substantive policy views that the centrists have. I don't share all of them. I'm a little more left of center, but I'm not very far away from their views. Where I disagree with them is on the politics, because not only do they have centrist views, but they seem to insist on, in addition to their views, on assigning blame to both parties equally, regardless of circumstance. Now, look, in the last budget cycle, President Obama put forward a budget compromise that's quite close to what the centrists say they want. It included a lot of cuts to retirement programs that liberals absolutely hate, and also asked for higher revenue by closing down some tax deductions. It was the kind of bargain and trade that the centrists have called for, and the Republicans turned it down and did not offer any kind of compromise proposal whatsoever in return. So it's just a matter of fact that one party is actually offering fiscal compromises of the sort the centrists have been calling for, and the other party is not doing that. But I think a lot of centrists feel that their credibility lies in always blaming both parties equally, so they can't really acknowledge that, which I think is a problem, because that turns out to simply encourage the more extreme party. Since the blame is going to be shared by both sides anyway, they feel they have nothing to lose by being as extremist as they've always been.
So a lot of analysts say that this is to do with the gerrymandering that the Republicans have engaged in successfully, and that these extremists and the Tea Party people don't have to worry about national politics as so much as they're both. In the case of Ted Cruz, he was able to use the Senate floor as a fundraising platform for his political ambitions and to placate the plutocrats who fund him, like the Koch brothers. So the theory now is that the Republican Party are only interested in the Republican primary, their candidates, and they're not focused on the national election. So are we going to have a situation where, and this is just to explain what's happening now, that you've got people behaving in what seems to be irrational ways, because it's not irrational to their constituents, but to a national audience later on it is?
Well, there's certainly some truth to this idea that gerrymandering has changed the playing field. But I think the political scientists who have looked at it don't think that that's the main cause. The main cause is simply the natural geographic distribution of Democrats and Republicans. The partisan landscape has really changed in this country over the last 15 to 20 years. And urban areas have become much more Democratic, and rural areas have become more Republican. You used to have a higher number of rural Democrats than you do now. And one effect of this change is that Democrats are just packed very tightly into these districts with overwhelming numbers of Democrats, which means wasted votes, right? If you have a district, any number you have in your district above 50% plus one is a wasted vote. That's a vote that's getting you past the finish line. You're already past. It's no good. Democrats have more of these wasted votes. So Republicans were able to win a majority of the House of Representatives, in part because they controlled more of the maps and gerrymandered, but in part just because of where they live, where Republicans may have these districts with 60%, but Democrats have 80, 90%. So Democrats received many more votes in the overall House election. I think 1.75 million more votes went Democratic than Republican in the last election. But Republicans have a near lock on the House of Representatives for these geographical reasons. Now, they helped reinforce the lock because the census happened in 2010, which was also a big Republican year. So Republicans won all these seats in 2010. Then they got to redraw all the political maps to make sure that their margin of error was dramatically increased.
Well, Jonathan Shade, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Shade, a writer for New York Magazine. He was previously senior editor at the New Republic and former assistant editor of the American Prospect. His latest article at New York Magazine is the House GOP's legislative strike. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the countdown to the shutdown.